Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 217. It's Monday, June 26th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, today I'd like to start with a series of stories for all of you folks that breathe air. First up, from Medical Express, air pollution, even at low levels, made COVID worse for patients and hospitals. Exposure to air pollution meant an average of 4 extra days in hospital for COVID-19 patients, further increasing the burden on healthcare systems, according to a new study published in the European Respiratory Journal. And I'd just like to say this series of stories, while this one's specifically about COVID, the whole point is that air quality and air pollution has a profound effect on our health. The researchers say the effect of pollution on patients' time in hospital was equivalent to being a decade older. Conversely, the effect of reducing exposure to pollution was forty to eighty percent as effective in reducing patients' time in hospital as some of the best treatments available. In a second study, also published in the European Respiratory Journal, researchers had used the data from all 3.7 million Danish people aged 30 or older to establish the impact of air pollution on COVID-19. They found that long-term exposure to pollution at levels well below current EU limits increased the risk of contracting COVID-19, being hospitalized, and dying of the disease. The research team used data on levels of three pollutants: nitrogen dioxide, soot, and fine particles, PM2.5, at the patient's home addresses before they were hospitalized with COVID-19. They also measured the amount of soot in the patient's blood. The researchers compared this data with clinical outcomes, such as how long patients had to remain in hospital before they were well enough to go home, and whether they were treated in intensive care. They took account of other factors that were known to affect COVID-19 infection, such as age, sex, and body mass index. This showed that people exposed to higher levels of fine particles and nitrogen dioxide in the week before they were hospitalized had to stay in hospital for more than 4 extra days on average. However, all levels of exposure were below the EU threshold. The size of the effect of air pollution on time in hospital was equivalent to the effect of a 10-year increase in age. The results also suggested that average exposure to higher levels of nitrogen dioxide and soot over the previous 4 years meant COVID-19 patients stayed longer in the hospital on average. Researchers found that higher levels of soot in the patient's blood increased the likelihood of their needing intensive care treatment by 36%. Professor Narwat, an author, said, "Our findings indicate that people who were exposed to air pollution, even at relatively low levels, were sicker and needed more time in hospital to recover. The pandemic placed an enormous strain on doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers. Our research suggests that air pollution made that burden even greater. Reduction of air pollution should be at the heart of preventive measures for current and future pandemics, as well as a strategy for dealing with seasonal influenza pandemics. Cleaner air would make populations more resilient to respiratory infections, seasonal epidemics, and major pandemics in the future." Okay, well, that story used COVID as an indicator of air pollution problems. This next one takes a more obscure disease, Kawasaki disease, and links it to air pollution from intensive agriculture and urban emissions, another interesting kind of convergence of problems in modern society that are creating problems. This from Medical Express. Kawasaki disease linked to air pollution from intensive agriculture and urban emissions. A study led by IS Global showed that the incidence of Kawasaki disease in Japan increases when fine metal-laden aerosols are detected in the atmosphere. These aerosols come from the area known as the breadbasket of China, where grain is intensively cultivated and combined with air from highly polluted urban areas of South Asia. Now, remember, this is in Japan. So it's not Japan producing the air pollution. This is one thing, obviously, with air pollution, is that it moves around. We all breathe air, and we share air across long areas of geography. Kawasaki disease is still poorly understood as a childhood disease. It is thought to occur when an unidentified pathogen enters the upper respiratory tract and causes a dramatic immune response in certain genetically predisposed children. In 20 to 25% of cases, coronary artery aneurysms develop, and in rare cases, the child can suffer sudden death or heart attack years later. In most cases, however, it presents as a rash and fever syndrome that is often mistaken for other more benign conditions, hence the risk. The peaks of Kawasaki disease always occur in full synchrony with the arrival of very small particles, which shows that ultrafine aerosols, which can travel long distances, appear to be a necessary cofactor among other still unknown factors for the appearance of this disease, explained the first author. Okay, and much of our air pollution problems is driven by global warming, and this next story gets to that. This from phys.org, P-H-Y-S as in physics.org. A cheap fix to global warming is finally gaining some support. Global support for one of the cheapest and most powerful climate actions is accelerated, and it couldn't come at a more urgent time. Countries are starting to get more serious about slashing avoidable methane emissions from fossil fuel production, as the rapidly warming planet forces leaders to double down on solutions that can rein in scorching temperatures within decades. Halting methane that is intentionally released or accidentally leaked from coal mines or natural gas and oil production is some of the lowest hanging fruit in the fight against climate change, because minimizing those emissions is often as simple as upgrading infrastructure and making it more efficient. Those refurbishments can generate more product that operators can sell. The International Energy Agency estimates that around 40% of oil and gas emissions could be implemented at no net cost. There is also significant potential to curb methane releases from large, porous underground coal mines, according to the agency. Although burning methane, the primary component of natural gas, still produces carbon dioxide, the warming impact is significantly less than if uncombusted gas escapes directly into the atmosphere. The U.S. government also is moving on several fronts to attack methane emissions from the oil fields. A marquee plan the Environmental Protection Agency is expected to finalize late this year would mandate routine monitoring of leaks at even small wells, require company blueprints for plugging them, and curtail the use of flaring when natural gas at oil wells is burned off as less potent carbon dioxide. U.S. regulators say oil and gas operators stand to claim over 80% of the revenue from the sale of natural gas that would be newly captured under the requirements. The expected methane emissions reductions from the EPA's proposed mandates aren't linear, and the agency didn't give an annual breakdown. However, averaging the estimated cuts over the 12-year time frame provided by the agency shows the rules would block roughly 2.7 million metric tons of methane from entering the atmosphere annually. Because methane is a potent greenhouse gas, the short-term climate impact would be equivalent to eliminating 225 million metric tons of carbon dioxide every year, or canceling Pakistan's total emissions. The U.S. and EU made methane a top issue ahead of COP26 in 2021, ultimately rallying some 150 nations behind the global pledge. Nearly 2 years after that pact was unveiled, focus has moved beyond enrolling more countries in the initiative to taking action on the ground. The goal of 30% reduction of global methane emissions by 2030 isn't likely to be met, according to David Oxley, head of climate economics at research group Capital Economics. However, Oxley wrote in a recent note that efforts to tackle methane emissions, quote, give us confidence that releases will start to decline this decade. Of course, the looming question is, will it be fast enough? Okay, well, now we can switch gears a little bit. Still sort of on the air pollution front, as cigarettes are the largest cause of indoor air pollution. But here's about e-cigs. This from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. E-cigs are still flooding the U.S., addicting teens with higher nicotine doses. When the FDA first asserted the authority to regulate e-cigarettes in 2016, many people assumed the agency would quickly get rid of vapes with flavors like cotton candy, gummy bears, and Fruit Loops that appeal to kids. Instead, the FDA allowed all cigarettes already on the market to stay while their manufacturers applied for the okay to market them. 7 years later, vaping has ballooned into an $8.2 billion industry, and manufacturers are flooding the market with thousands of products, most sold illegally and without FDA permission. And that can be far more addictive. The FDA has failed to protect public health, said Eric Lindblom, a former senior advisor to the director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. It's a tragedy. Meanwhile, today's vapes have become bigger, badder, and cheaper than older models, said Robin Koval, CEO of the Truth Initiative, a tobacco control advocacy group. The enormous amount of nicotine in e-cigarettes, up 76% over 5 years, can addict kids in a matter of days. E-cigarettes in the U.S. now contain nicotine concentrations that are on average more than twice the level allowed in Canada and Europe. The U.S. sets no limits on the nicotine content of any tobacco product. More than 2.5 million kids used e-cigarettes in 2022, including 14% of high school students, according to the CDC. The potential for profits and lax enforcement of vaping laws has led to a gold rush. The number of unique vaping products, as measured by their barcodes, quadrupled in just 1 year, rising from 453 in June of 2021 to 2,023 in June of 2022, according to the Truth Initiative review of U.S. retail sales data. FDA officials say they've been overwhelmed by the volume of e-cigarette marketing applications, 26 million in all. I've reported on that before, and it's just stunning to me. 26 million marketing applications have been applied. There's only 350 million people in the whole country. So like 8% of people are having companies to give a marketing application. Stunning. There is no regulatory agency in the world that has had to deal with a volume like that, said Brian King, who became director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products in July 2022. The agency has struggled to stop e-cigarette makers who continue selling vapes despite the FDA's rejection of the products, as well as manufacturers who never bother to apply for authorization and counterfeiters hoping to earn as much money as possible before being shut down. In 2018, public health groups sued the agency, charging that the delay in reviewing applications put kids at risk. Although a court ordered the FDA to finish the job by September 2021, the FDA missed that deadline. An estimated 1.2 million people under the legal age of 21 began vaping over that next year, according to a study published this May in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Recently, the FDA announced it has made decisions on 99% of e-cigarette applications, noting that it rejected millions and authorized 23. All authorized products have traditional tobacco flavors and were deemed, quote, appropriate for the protection of public health because tobacco-flavored products aren't popular with children but provide adult smokers with less dangerous alternatives. Now, I would note that I've done a lot of reporting that I initially had hopes that e-cigarettes would be less dangerous than cigarettes, but it doesn't look like there's really much difference, if any. Very scary. The agency has yet to make final decisions on the most popular products on the market. Those applications are longer and need more careful scientific review, said Mitch Zeller, former director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. The FDA said it would not complete reviewing applications by the end of June, as it previously forecast, but would need until the end of the year. Before the FDA can announce new tobacco policies, it needs approval from the president, who doesn't always agree with the FDA's priorities. There's an unusual politicization there, having the president have final veto authority on that. For example, Obama rejected FDA officials' proposal to ban kid-friendly flavors in 2016. And in 2020, Trump backpedaled on his own plan to pull most flavored vapes off the market. Instead of banning all fruit and minty flavors, the Trump administration banned them only in, quote, cartridge-based devices such as Juul. The flavor ban didn't affect vapes without cartridges, such as disposable e-cigarettes. The result was predictable, Zeller said. Teens switched and drove from Juul to brands that weren't affected by the ban, including disposable vapes such as Puff Bar, which were allowed to continue selling candy-flavored vapes. After receiving its own warning letter from the FDA last year, Puff Bar now sells only zero nicotine vapes. When the FDA does attempt bold action, legal challenges often force it to halt or even reverse course. The FDA ordered Juul to remove its products from the market in June 2022, but was immediately hit with a lawsuit. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit sided with Juul and issued a temporary stay on the FDA's order. Within weeks, the FDA announced it would hold off on enforcing its order because of, quote, scientific issues unique to the Juul application that warranted additional review. E-cigarette makers Logic and R.J. Reynolds Vapor Company both sued the FDA after the agency ordered them to stop selling menthol vapes, a popular flavor with teens. In both cases, court-imposed stays halted the FDA's orders pending review, and the company's menthol products remain on the market. Under the Biden administration, the FDA has begun to step up enforcement efforts. It fined 12 e-cigarette manufacturers more than $19,000 each and has issued more than 1,500 warning letters to manufacturers. The FDA also issued warnings to 120,000 retailers for selling illegal products or selling to customers under 21. Five of the companies that received warning letters made vapes decorated with cartoon characters, such as Minions or shaped like toys, including Nintendo Game Boys or walkie-talkies. In May, the FDA put Elf Bar and other unauthorized vapes from China on its, quote, red list, which allows FDA agents to detain shipments without inspection at the border. On June 22nd, the FDA announced it had issued warning letters to an additional 189 retailers for selling unauthorized tobacco products, specifically Elf Bar and Esco Bars products, noting that both brands are disposable e-cigarettes that come in flavors known to appeal to youth, including bubblegum and pink lemonade. In October, the Justice Department for the first time filed a lawsuit against six e-cigarette manufacturers on behalf of the FDA, seeking, quote, to stop the illegal manufacture and sale of unauthorized vaping products. Some lawmakers say the Justice Department should play a larger role in prosecuting companies selling kid-friendly e-cigarettes. Make no mistake, there are more than six e-cigarette manufacturers selling without authorization in the market, Senator Dick Durbin said in a March letter. Children are vaping with unauthorized products that are on store shelves only because the FDA has seemingly granted these illegal cigarettes a free pass. Well, in closing, if you or someone you know is interested in quitting smoking, you can contact the Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, next up, I have a story on the annual scorecard for U.S. states' healthcare systems. This from CNN. Report finds nationwide spike in preventable deaths, maternal mortality, and medical bills. A new report puts U.S. states' healthcare systems on a scorecard, with Massachusetts coming out on top. But it also highlights alarming trends across the country, especially in areas like premature deaths and women's healthcare. Released last Thursday, the Commonwealth Fund's 2023 scorecard on state health system performance uses federal health data from 2021, the most recent available, to rank all 50 states in D.C. on 58 measures of health outcomes, equity, and affordability. And for the first time, researchers from the Independent Research Group measured performance on reproductive care and women's health, including 12 measures to track prenatal and postpartum care access, reproductive cancer screenings, and maternal mortality. The researchers found a surge in preventable deaths in every state, with Black and American Indian Alaskan Native people experiencing the highest mortality rates in many places. They also noted that many Americans with mental health needs face barriers to obtain the care they need, and millions of people, particularly in the South, struggle to pay off medical debt. That spike was largely driven by COVID-19 deaths, the report says. The pandemic also contributed to heightened substance abuse and barriers to care for chronic but treatable diseases like diabetes and cancer. And there were major delays in routine checkups, which turned some ordinarily treatable diseases into fatal diseases. The study also highlighted an increase in mental and behavioral health issues during the pandemic. In 2021, for the first time, combined deaths from drug overdoses, alcohol, and suicide claimed more than 200,000 lives, an increase of 50,000 from 2019, before the pandemic. Despite the rise in mental health crises, the report found that 60% of adolescents who had a major depressive episode did not receive treatment. The same was true of 55% of adults facing mental illness. more than 40% found treatment too expensive. The death rate for American Indian Alaskan Native mothers jumped by nearly 70 deaths per 100,000 live births, far more than that of any other racial or ethnic group. The study authors attribute this inequality to a number of causes, including poverty, food insecurity, and disparities in insurance coverage. And across the board, deaths from all causes among women of reproductive age, that's ages 15 to 44, jumped nearly 40% from 2019 to 2021. Maternal deaths helped drive that increase, but preventable deaths from COVID and substance abuse also played a major role. However, those all-cause death rates among women varied widely from state to state. West Virginia, for instance, had an all-cause death rate triple that of Hawaii. Now, our country's fractured landscape of reproductive health access will only make it difficult to close these widening gaps, especially for women of color and women with low incomes in states that have restricted access to reproductive care. The report uses reproductive health data before the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June of 2022. Since then, 26 states have imposed restrictions on abortion, including 12 of the 15 states ranked lowest in reproductive care and women's health by the scorecard. The researchers warn that continued restrictions could limit access to high-quality preventive health care, including contraception and reproductive cancer screenings, that could exacerbate disparities for women.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I have a story on a common chronic disease, diabetes, which is getting more common. This is from Medical Express. Diabetes cases to double to 1.3 billion by 2050. The number of people suffering from diabetes worldwide will more than double to 1.3 billion by 2050, driven by structural racism and gaping inequality between countries, new research predicted. Every country in the globe will see an increase in number of patients with this chronic disease, according to the most comprehensive analysis of global data projecting out to 2050. Some 529 million people were estimated to already be living with diabetes, one of the top 10 causes of death and disability. That number, 95% of which are cases of type 2 diabetes, will top 1.3 billion in less than 3 decades, according to the study published in The Lancet. High body mass index, an indication that people could be overweight, was linked to more than half of deaths and disability from diabetes. Other factors include people's diets, exercise, smoking, and alcohol. Leon Ong, lead research scientist at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, the first author of one of the studies, said one factor was how diets had changed. Over the course of 30 years, different countries have really migrated from traditional food habits, maybe eating more fruits and vegetables, eating healthier greens, to more highly processed food. The research also estimated that by 2045, 3/4 of adults with diabetes will live in low and middle income countries. But even in wealthy countries such as the United States, diabetes rates were almost 1.5 times higher among minorities such as Black, Hispanic, Asian, or Native Americans, a separate Lancet study said. Study co-author Leonard Egede of the Medical College of Wisconsin blamed, quote, a cascade of widening diabetes inequity. Racist policies such as residential segregation affect where people live, their access to sufficient and healthy food, and healthcare services. Ong said the challenge is that we don't really see one type of intervention that's going to fix everything. As in public health, there are a few silver bullets. Instead, fighting diabetes will require long-term planning, investment, and attention from countries around the globe. In an editorial, The Lancet said that, quote, the world has failed to understand the social nature of diabetes and underestimated the true scale and threat the disease poses. Diabetes will be a defining disease of this century, it added. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears a little bit and do a story on pedestrian deaths. And to put this in context, motor vehicle crash deaths in the U.S. have hovered around lately, around 25,000 a year. So this from Medical Express. Danger afoot. U.S. pedestrian deaths at highest level in 41 years. More than 7,500 people were killed last year after being struck by vehicles while walking along or across U.S. roadways. The most pedestrian deaths in more than four decades, according to a new report. The sobering trend was not surprising to experts who track the numbers, but they were dismayed by the consistent increase, up 77% since 2010. While pedestrian deaths have been rising sharply over the past dozen years, other traffic-related deaths also increased, but at a lower 25%. In 2021, about 77% of pedestrian fatalities happened after dark. Nighttime crash deaths have increased by 86% since 2010, compared to a 31% increase in daytime pedestrian deaths. Passenger cars accounted for most crashes, but deaths involving SUVs increased at a faster rate. These bigger and heavier vehicles, along with light trucks, can cause more harm to a pedestrian in a crash. Some of these larger vehicles, the driver's sight lines are not clearly as good. It's harder to see people close to the vehicle, so it can be harder to prevent a collision. Larger and heavy vehicles are definitely one of the factors behind the awful surge in deaths. One recent positive is a rule proposed by the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration regarding pedestrian automatic emergency braking. That would mandate systems, already available in some vehicles, that would detect pedestrians and automatically apply the brakes if the driver fails to do so in time. About 69% of pedestrian fatalities happen in places with no sidewalks, up from 59% in 2017. Sidewalks can protect people by separating them from vehicle traffic, but other infrastructure designs such as raised crosswalks and traffic calming devices that slow vehicles down can provide even more protection. Data don't prove why, but one hypothesis is the increased use of smartphones. All that progress that was made over 30 years, we've just lost that. Among the other changes he noted was a shift in pedestrian deaths from downtown areas to suburbs in the past decade, though arterial roadways are still the most common sites. While researchers would like to better understand what's happening, they do know what might work for reduction, including getting speeds under control and providing better and more crossing infrastructure. Not only is it terrible that all these people are being killed, but also think about the safety issues as the main barrier of people being out and walking and biking. Lots of people are being killed on these streets, but there's a lot of people that are saying, those streets are so unsafe, I'm not even going to try to walk or bike out there. And then that's holding us back from environmental emissions goals, and it's holding us back from public health goals and air pollution and equity concerns. Drivers can themselves make a big difference, using 100% of their attention whenever they're behind the wheel. And as a regular biker, I can tell you by observing drivers that we're far from 100% of their attention whenever they're behind the wheel. Okay, well, let's change gears again. This from Axios. Mosquito days are getting worse due to climate change. The number of mosquito days, that is those with the hot and humid weather that flying insects crave, has increased in many U.S. cities over the past several decades. The report from nonprofit climate science research organization Climate Central defines a mosquito day as one with the average relative humidity of 42% or higher, plus daily temperatures between 50 and 95 degrees Fahrenheit. Why it matters? Mosquitoes are more than just a nuisance. They're a public health threat, carrying diseases such as malaria, West Nile, Zika, and more. 71% of the 242 locations Climate Central analyzed saw an increase in mosquito days between 1979 and 2022. Of about 16 days on average was the increase. The bottom line, mosquitoes and the diseases they sometimes carry are shaping up as one more climate change-induced problem for many local officials to worry about. And in another malaria-related story, this one more good news that we can do something about this. This from the World Health Organization. Belize certified malaria-free by World Health Organization. The WHO has certified Belize as malaria-free following the country's over 70 years of continued efforts to stamp out the disease. WHO congratulates the people and government of Belize and their network of global and local partners for this achievement, said the Director General. Belize is another example of how, with the right tools and the right approach, we can dream of a malaria-free future. With this announcement, a total of 42 countries and one territory have been certified as malaria-free by WHO, including 11 countries in the region of the Americas. Following the achievement of Paraguay, Argentina, and El Salvador, Belize today becomes the fourth country in the Americas and the second in Central America to be certified as free of malaria over the last 5 years. This is an extraordinary achievement for Belize and will also serve as inspiration for the other endemic countries in the Americas. Belize is the third country to be awarded a malaria-free status in 2023, following certifications of Azerbaijan and Tajikistan in March. And I will note that there have been confirmed local transmission of malaria in Texas and Florida. So as climate change moves mosquitoes farther up north, we're starting to see malaria in the U.S. Maybe Belize can teach us a thing or two. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, I have a story about traumatic brain injury, and oftentimes people think this is something, and once you get it, you wait and maybe get some treatment and it gets better. But this study shows there's a wide variety of responses. Some people get better, some people get worse. This from Medical Express. Traumatic brain injury should be recognized as a chronic condition, study argues. People with traumatic brain injury may continue to improve or decline years after the injury, making it a more chronic illness, according to a study published in the issue of Neurology. Our results dispute the notion that traumatic brain injury is a one-time event with a stagnant outcome after a short period of recovery, said study author Benjamin Brett of the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Rather, people with traumatic brain injury continue to show improvement and decline across a range of areas, including their ability to function and their thinking skills. These findings point out the need to recognize traumatic brain injury as a chronic condition in order to establish adequate care that supports the evolving needs of people with this condition. This type of care should place a greater emphasis on helping people have shown improvement to continue to improve and implementing greater levels of support for those who have shown decline. Okay, next up, another story in a continuing series of bizarro stories about American healthcare. This is from Stat News. Bloated patient records are filled with false information thanks to copy and paste. Electronic copying and pasting has become a major problem in healthcare. A recent study of 100 million notes consisting of 33 billion words in the electronic medical record at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center found that more than half of the text was duplicated. The copied and pasted content was prevalent in notes written by everyone from nurses and therapists to physicians at all levels of training. Finding the right information is no longer a matter of flipping through a paper chart, the study authors wrote. It is more akin to reading large portions of a book. From 2009 to 2018, as electronic medical records became ubiquitous, chart notes doubled in length. In the Penn study, the average patient record had more than half the word count of Shakespeare's Hamlet. The majority of that content was copied and pasted word for word. With the computerization of medical notes, healthcare providers can now easily copy and manipulate large swaths of previously documented information. Surveys show that most healthcare providers admit to using copy and paste functions when writing clinical notes. For instance, physicians frequently copy medical histories obtained by other physicians or chart notes from prior hospitalizations. Such cribbing is encouraged by the current medical billing system, in which chart documentation is used not only for clinical, but also legal and financial purposes. Notes are dissected by billing agents to maximize hospital revenue. More details, often irrelevant ones, often result in more money. Adding more diagnoses to a chart note, for example, even if extraneous, may make a patient look sicker and garner more payments. The resulting redundancy often obscures important information, the proverbial needle in a haystack problem. Indeed, today's chart notes, filled with unnecessary and often copied details, are causing physicians to make diagnostic errors. Overworked clinicians may be disincentivized from reading such a bloated record, the authors of the Penn study wrote, and in an obvious understatement, adding that this can lead to wasted time repeating past interventions or directly causing patient harm by missing findings requiring follow-up. Moreover, content is being copied without confirming the accuracy of the information being duplicated. In a 2017 study of approximately 24,000 notes written by 460 clinicians at University of California, San Francisco Medical Center, more than 80% of the text was copied or imported from a previous document. This practice, the authors wrote, increases the risk of including outdated, inaccurate, or unnecessary information, which can undermine the utility of notes and lead to clinical error. None of this should come as any great surprise. Information overload and frank misinformation are defining features of our digital lives. However, the effects on the profession of medicine should be of great concern. The amount of information generated by a typical physician-patient encounter has always been voluminous. In a survey published in 2013 of nearly 2,600 primary care physicians, 70% reported receiving more information, lab tests, imaging studies, and written assessments than they could manage. Both the advent of electronic medical charts and the rampant use of copying and pasting, information overload and errors have multiplied. I dare say that doctors were more diligent about the accuracy of their notes when they were written freehand in paper charts. Texts could not be copied and pasted. Today, information is readily archived and manipulated, propagating mistakes. Even when the information is technically accurate, notes today often rehash events that have already occurred or problems that have already been solved. This wastes time and impairs decision-making. Adding minute details about a patient's prior hospitalizations often only confuses the problem at hand. In addition, a narrative element is often missing in medical charts today, as chunks of information are pasted haphazardly into notes. Narratives humanize patients, who, despite what modern electronic medical records may suggest, are not disconnected lists of copied and pasted facts. No doubt, electronic medical records have produced great benefits too. Doctors can now access patients' information virtually anywhere, though this may also be contributing to widespread clinician burnout. Computerized order entry reduces medication errors. However, we must get smarter about how we use the power of electronic charts. First, hospitals need to design a system that encourages the documentation of truly novel and accurate information. Relatively stable patient information should be stored separately and not be repeated in daily notes, contributing to bloat. This will require a change in how physician-patient interactions are billed so that long notes that include irrelevant details are not monetarily rewarded. Furthermore, as the authors of the Penn study argue, some duplication may be eliminated by having a single-day progress note that multiple physicians can add to and edit. Hospitals may also consider restricting the use of copying and pasting. At the very least, copied and pasted material should be readily identifiable so it can be checked for accuracy. Okay, well, another facet of the digital lives of physicians, this from Stat News. Peter Hotez is not alone. Online harassment of doctors is a public health issue. So Peter Hotez is a vaccine researcher and physician who's done a lot of public education about vaccines and has been harassed online and was actually confronted at his home by stalkers. So, JAMA Network Open recently published our study of more than 350 physicians and scientists' experiences with online harassment. What we found was frightening. In addition to being accosted at their home or place of business, our participants reported doxing, that is, having personal information posted online, stalking, and professional harm such as review bombing, that is, posting multiple fake negative reviews online. 2 in 3 physicians reported having experienced harassment. That's up significantly. When we conducted a similar study before the pandemic began, 23% of the physicians reported having been harassed. In the latest study, physicians and scientists like Hotez, who use social media to post public health messages, were significantly more likely than those who did not to report online harassment. Most, that is 88% of the physicians who experienced harassment in our study, felt that it was caused by their advocacy efforts on social media. The responses in the recent study horrified us. I have semi-routinely been harassed with violent threats, wrote one physician, including menacing messages like, we'll see you soon, and pictures such as images of individuals being hung. Another person wrote, I've been doxxed several times, including fake social media accounts with my unique name, and Pornhub with my photos mixed in with a nude model. Hotez's persistence on social media in the face of such online harassment is impressive. It's been reported that many physicians and scientists are leaving or considering modifying their use of social media for their mental health, physical safety, or both. This is deeply troubling as the pandemic shed light on the critical role that social media can play in disseminating medical and scientific knowledge to the public. Not only do high levels of online harassment contribute to physician burnout, our study suggests that this is leading to more physicians and scientists changing the way they use social media. This will leave the propagation of misinformation unchecked by the most qualified to address it. In short, harassment seems to be effective. Online harassment is not unique to doctors and scientists. According to a recent Pew study, 40% of Americans have been subject to online harassment. Half of those who have experienced online attacks cite their political views as the reason. For one-third of those who reported harassment, it was severe, such as sexual harassment, physical threats, or stalking. Unsurprisingly, the public expects social media companies to be held accountable, but only 18% believe they are doing a good job at addressing online harassment or bullying. The majority of Americans believe social media companies can improve reporting mechanisms for flagging hateful content, 78%, increase user control of their experience, 78%, improve transparency, 77%, and improve accountability through independent reports of types of harassment, 69%. The majority of Americans are directly at odds with Twitter owners' changes. The status quo is not acceptable. Regardless of your personal, professional, or political beliefs, everyone should condemn harassment, both online and off. Not only do attacks on physicians and scientists threaten the physical and mental health of these individuals, they also threaten public safety by limiting access to scientific and medical expertise in online discussions, where false and inadequate medical information can often thrive and perpetuate. Employers, schools, professional organizations, both in and outside of medicine, should develop toolkits, frameworks, and ways to support victims. However, to truly address this problem, state and federal policymakers should hold both social media and technology companies accountable and also enforce stricter regulations for egregious social media harassment, like doxing. Peter Hotez deserves it. So do all of us. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, that leaves us with our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all of the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. And since last week was a brand new Greatest Hits episode, I had a lot of backed up bonus articles, so I have a record this week of 32, so let's get rolling. Number one, the world rallied to find missing Titan sub but ignored shipwrecked migrants. This is a Scientific American argument that deals with the ethics and psychology behind this, and it's good to see that scientists recognize that we live in what should be an ethical world. Bonus article two, heat waves are unleashing a deadly but overlooked pollutant, ozone, and a companion article. Three, wildfire smoke reacts with city pollution, creating new toxic air hazard, ozone. So we've got both excess heat and smoke that are producing pollution problems. And the next article sort of pulls that all together. Bonus article four, how America solved its first air pollution crisis and why solving the next one will be harder. And that's partly because of wildfires and increasing temperatures. And that article is also a great backgrounder on just kind of the history of air pollution in this country. Bonus article five, the new war on bad air for better ventilated buildings. So this is kind of the different, I've talked about this before, is that for air pollution, outside air pollution, you actually want to close up your house and do better ventilation. But for like viral and bacterial stuff that you can get out of the air, you actually want better ventilated buildings. Although there are things like UV lights and stuff that are could be used to actually kill the bacteria or viruses in the house, so you don't have to get necessarily fresh, so-called fresh air from the outside. Bonus article six, meet the Texas commissioners who could stymie Biden's climate agenda by approving methane releases. So there's some Texas commissioners that are bought by the energy industry, and since they're part of the administrative structure of the climate laws, requires their oversight, these commissioners could just allow huge amounts of methane releases. And since Texas is a huge producer of these methane releases, could stymie a lot of the Biden's hopes for climate change reduction. Bonus article seven, how to build a zero-waste circular economy. These businesses say reuse, refill, and return. Got to get some good news in those environmental stories. But back to bad news, article eight, Navy weapon tests in Potomac spark environmental lawsuit. So for over 100 years, the Navy's been testing ordnance, millions of pounds, just launching it off in the Potomac, and this caused environmental problems. Unfortunately, an example of the military causing environmental problems from both testing to actually using weapons, and for, of course, the huge organization that it is uses a lot of energy and creates a lot of environmental problems. Bonus article nine, Supreme Court rules against Navajo Nation in Colorado River case voiding water rights. So unfortunately, this is an example of our Supreme Court being supposedly pro-life, but as Native people will say, water is life. And by voiding water rights, meaning the affirmative responsibility by treaty that the U.S. said it was going to provide the Navajo Nation, they no longer have rights that they had before. Bonus article 10, harsh new fentanyl laws ignite debate over how to combat overdose crisis, law enforcement versus public health. Those two worldviews tend to be very different in many cases that I've reported before. And people get this kind of a common sense idea that law enforcement interdiction types of approaches will work, when in fact they actually often make the problem worse. Bonus article 11. Abortion bans are causing chilling effect for OB-GYNs, says poll of OB-GYNs. They ought to know. Bonus article 12. Even in states where it is illegal, abortion isn't as accessible as the laws make it seem. So this is a rundown state by state if you're interested in getting details on that. Bonus article 13, malpractice lawsuits over denied abortion care may be on the horizon. So the fact that we've had this legal criminalizing approach of healthcare, we're going to get some pushback probably. And the other thing is that when women are actually denied abortion care, there may be lawsuits for that denial. So pushing back on the fact that a lot of physicians are nervous about violating these draconian laws that are being passed. Bonus article 14, abortion is ancient history. Long before Roe, women terminated pregnancies. So this is just a good historical overview of abortion in history. Bonus Article 15. States with abortion bans or severe limits far outpace those offering paid family leave. None of the 25 anti-abortion states offer any paid family leave. This double whammy of mandated birth and state neglect has grave health consequences. Article 16. Medical exiles. Families flee states amid crackdown on transgender care. So again, as we're criminalizing health care, it's creating refugees, medical refugees within our country. Bonus Article 17. Everything you need to know about gender-affirming care. Throw that one in there as another primer if you have questions about that. Bonus Article 18. How does trauma spill from one generation to the next? Short story is both genetically and through culture and society. Bonus Article 19. Americans are drinking as much alcohol now as in the Civil War days. So alcohol use has gone up since a low point in 1995, and there was a high point actually in 1980, but kind of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, that whole thing, really did have an effect on alcohol consumption, but it's been increasing the last 20 years or so. Bonus Article 20, head hits, not concussions, tied to CTE. So this is this trauma that happens from many thousands of head hits. And actually, concussions themselves don't have any association with CTE. It's actually the head hits. So it's practicing a sport where you have head hits over and over and over for many years where you get thousands of hits. Bonus Article 21. New study links combined contraceptive pills and depression. This was a huge prospective study, a very good study. And this is for the combined progestogen, I think is what it's called, the combined contraceptive pill. It didn't study other types of contraceptive pills, but that's a major one with depression. So might be something you want to check out. 22, in-hospital delivery-related maternal mortality on the decline, but the prevalence of severe maternal morbidity increase. So this is interesting. It's good news in the sense that for the in-hospital portion of maternal mortality, we're doing a better job at preventing death. But actually, the prevalence of severe maternal morbidity is actually increasing. And in-hospital maternal mortality isn't even half of maternal mortality. That is, death during pregnancy or the first year after birth, which gets back to the public health and social determinants are actually driving this. But good news on the hospital front, healthcare front. Bonus Article 23. BMI versus body fat percentages when classifying obesity. Well, as a public health nutritionist, I find this one very interesting because I've read a lot where people are complaining that BMI isn't accurate, which is actually true. There's a lot of limitations of that. It isn't very well correlated with body fat percentage itself. But the funny thing is when people bring that up, they're usually talking about, oh, there's like a football player who's muscle bound and he would be classified as obese by the BMI, but they're actually, you know, they're not obese. That is not the problem. In fact, the misclassification, if you look at body fat percentage, when you actually measure that accurately, you have people who have normal BMI who are actually obese because they have a high body fat percentage, which would be 25% or more for men and 35% or more for women. So also what that means is that the obesity epidemic is actually worse than measuring it through BMI. Bonus Article 24, night owls more likely to die younger, study says, but the problem isn't sleep, it's drinking and smoking. So this has been something we've known for a long time, that night owls are slightly more likely to die than larks, morning people. But when you actually control for the different types of habits that people have, it isn't actually this effect on sleep, it's drinking and smoking. Night owls tend to drink and smoke more. 25, it's beyond unethical. Opaque conflicts of interest permeate prescription drug benefits. So this is just basically kickbacks that are happening between companies that actually are so-called consultants that corporations hire to get their prescription drug benefits, and they've got direct financial conflicts of interest. Literally getting paid for bad deals. Bonus Article 26, the biotech edge, how executives and well-connected investors make exquisitely timed trades in healthcare stocks. So this is basically just insider trading. 27, you're not God. Doctors and patients' families say say HCA hospitals push hospice care. So I've reported on how often we don't use hospice care enough and how hospice care has declined because venture capital has got into it. But this one is actually, these HCA hospital system is actually pushing patients into hospice care because they want to lower their death rates of their patients. So they get them out before they die. So they're getting inappropriate hospital care and inappropriate hospice care. Yikes. 28, the moral crisis of America's doctors practicing in America's corporate healthcare. Talked about moral injury before, and it's a crisis for America's doctors. 29, LA voters could clamp down on pay for hospital executives. They have a voter initiative where they could limit hospital executive pay to $450,000 a year. Oh my God, nobody can live on that. Bonus article 30, why do we tolerate our health insurance problem? This is actually a rhetorical question. It doesn't really answer why we tolerate, but it does list out a lot of the problems. And one of the problems that really stuck out to me in this litany is that the ACA requires, Obamacare requires that you spend like 80 or 85% of the dollars that you take in on premiums to be spent on actual health care. But when these large conglomerates, healthcare conglomerates, have more profits than that, and they would have to be like reimbursed back to the people that they're insuring, they just shift them to another part of their business. So in essence, they're like tax lawyers for the rich, and they end up not abiding by those limits. 31, how AI could spark the next pandemic by make it easier to make dangerous germs. Woo! That's a very different one. That's a good read though. And lastly, but not least, back to one of mine as a public health nutritionist, food. 32, they only want you to believe it's food. The ultra-processed food industry rules. So this is a good overview of that and give some really nasty examples of how they're pushing ultra-processed food on people who are harmed the most by it. You can view these and other stories that I've reported on in this show and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-